Hi, Drumstick. Oh, Drumstick, I think, is going to be very happy.
I feel confident because I'm the best player in the world.
And we had the most beautiful piece of chocolate cake that you've ever seen.
Did you do any PEDs?
No.
Did you do anything that they accuse you of?
No.
People are laughing at us all over the world. They think we're stupid. And we are. I mean, we're being led by stupid people.
That I needed to arm myself, that I needed to protect Reva and I, that I needed to get my gun.
We, the jury, in the above entitled action, find the defendant, Orenthal James Simpson, not guilty of the crime of murder.
There's massive, massive sports betting going on.
We won with poorly educated. I love the poorly educated.
Touchdown! Only Mahomes!
I'm a very stable genius.
It's time for Offside. Now, here's your host, TSN Informs legal analyst and Canada's favorite lawyer, Eric Macramella.
He's a lawyer.
Hello, welcome to the show that is Offside. I'm Eric Macramella, your host here, along with my co-host, Steve King Kong Bunda. Steve? How you doing, my man?
I'm great, Eric. I'm great. How are you doing? Thanks for having me back. Thanks for, you know, it's wild. There's snow everywhere. It's a Canadian winter. People are complaining. I'm pushing people's cars out. We're having a good week. How are you doing?
Well, this is the thing I don't understand. Okay, a lot on the show today, we'll talk NHL expansion, NHL tanking. Bettman says it doesn't exist. Mike Levinger's domestic violence against his two baby mamas and his kids as well. Talk about Josh Norris and Tanner Peterson and choosing your own surgery. Donald Trump loses the week, yada, yada, yada. But the first thing is that people who live in Canada just seem to be surprised every winter that there's snow. And we get these advisories, winter storm, 20 centimeters. That's not a storm, right? We're Canadian. This is normal. It seems like, Steve, some news channels become the weather channel. You know what I do when I want to know the weather? I open the window. That's what I do. Or I look at my telephone, and in 6 seconds, I know how much it's going to snow here, how much it's going to snow in Winnipeg, in case I'm curious, right?
At Shea, Eric, though, do you have a huge, canopy over your house to kind of protect you from all the snow? Because, you're rich from all the radio work you do. So
radio is very lucrative, yes.
Exactly. So I feel like you can just have not only people shoveling for you, but doing everything, but you have so much of a palace built that you don't even see snow.
I do shovel because I'm married and I got to get out of the house. And I've noticed so many husbands shoveling, even in summer, because they just want to get out of the house. Because when you're in the house, your wife is giving you a PowerPoint presentation on how to load the dishwasher, which is extremely attractive, by the way. I love that. It is I never felt closer to her when she's on slide number 57 entitled Fancy Coffee Cups. Oh, she's a sweet, sweet girl. No, typically what happens is my butler walks around with an umbrella over my head, even inside the house, because as I always tell him, practice makes perfect. All right, let's start with NHL tanking. Gary Bettman, in his usual sweet, kind, non-condescending way, has said that nobody tanks. So here, let me play this clip for you, and then why don't we talk about it? Okay, so here's the clip: Gary Bettman denying that NHL teams tank.
Nobody tanks because we have a weighted lottery, and you're not going to lose games to increase your odds by a couple of percentage points. That's silly. And frankly, suggesting tanking, I believe, is inconsistent with the professionalism that our players and our coaches have. Nobody tanks. Our players and our coaches do their best to win. And again, just because you may finish with the worst record in the league, you've got something like a 75% chance that you're not going to get the first pick.
Okay, so a couple thoughts on that, Steve, and I'll toss it to you. Here's the thing. Is that Gary Bettman says there's no tanking because of the lottery. But from my vantage point, I don't know if anyone's talked about this, but from my vantage point, when the team adopted this lottery, it went from three teams having a shot at the first overall pick to 11 teams having a shot at the overall pick. So that strikes me as incentivizing, if not encouraging, more teams to tank or just not try very hard because they have a legitimate bona fide chance at getting the first overall pick. 11 teams have that. I understand the odds decrease dramatically as you get to teams 9, 10, and 11, but they still have that shot. And so it would seem to me that the current lottery system actually encourages tanking rather than dissuades tanking. That's the first thing. Second thing is that, look, you can put in place all the rules and policies and guidelines you want in place, Steve, to discourage any type of behavior. But the outcome is what these teams focus on. Namely, can I get the first overall pick? So they are not going to be discouraged from tanking because you have a lottery system in place, which, again, I believe actually encourages teams to tank rather than discourages those teams to tank. But those teams are saying, look, I don't have 100% chance getting the first overall pick, but the outcome, namely getting a guy like Connor Bedard, could change the trajectory of our franchise, could alter our destiny. And that's something that I'm willing to roll the dice on. And so you can put in place all the different kinds of lotteries and rules you want in place, but teams will assess ultimate outcome. And is that a result, Steve, that I want? And if it is, no rules or policies or guidelines, Steve, are going to change that.
No, and I think we've seen too. We're seeing more now in terms of teams that are, you know, selling off pieces, but they're also, when you go and make trades now, they're protecting their lottery picks, like lottery protected picks, like top three, except protected, the Panthers. Top five. Well, exactly, except for the Panthers.
That's a shame.
It really is.
That's such a fireable offense.
Yeah, such a great place to play hockey too in Florida, right?
But it's a good thing that they signed Sherratt to a 10-year deal. Kidding. In Detroit, underachieving.
It's interesting because I want to believe he's smart, Gary Bettman, but it also feels like he's very much naive if he's going to believe that teams don't put themselves. So sure, tanking isn't exactly what happens, but teams set themselves up to give themselves the best possibility at getting the first overall pick, whether it's trading off, you know, pieces to get multiple first round picks or multiple picks in the first, you know, top 10, whatever. But at the same time, why are teams protecting picks then? Because they realize, like you said, in the lottery, that they have an opportunity at any time to win that first overall pick, to get a Connor Bedard. You know, you look at the Edmonton Oilers years ago when they had 11 first round picks in a row, it feels like, because they just kept winning. And it doesn't work in that sense because something they didn't build, and they're, you know, they got Connor McDavid. But since then, it's like, all right, they're still struggling a bit. So I don't buy the teams don't tank. Sure, they don't tank, but you want to use another word. I think that teams put themselves in the best possible position to get themselves that first overall pick.
Yeah, and, you know, tanking is what the Blackhawks did. Trading away DeBrincat, trading away Kirby Dach, and ensuring that you suck. And they're in the penultimate place in the standings. Columbus is in last place for now. But that's a clear attempt to tank. But you don't need to tank to have a shot at the first pick. You just maintain the status quo. You don't, you don't improve your team. And that probably, you could argue that's a form of tanking. Now, Gary Bettman, by the way, is incredibly intelligent. He is one of the smartest guys in the rooms, absolutely. But he's talking to us and trying to sell us a bill of goods. He's right in that coaches and players don't tank. No, they don't. Of course not. NHL players, some of them realize they're a shift away from the beer league and they give all they can every single shift. And every player is proud and wants to win. Coaches don't tank. Players don't tank. Management tanks. That's what happens. Go, here's your team. Coach it. Go ahead. Players, do the best you can. But I put you in an impossible position to succeed. And that's what the Blackhawks have done with their coach and their players. So this whole notion that teams, that management, that they don't tank, I think when you make that declaration as the commissioner, I understand the reason behind that statement, and I understand the motivation behind the statement, because you want to convey to the public that every team is giving the old college try. But it doesn't seem realistic. It doesn't seem realistic. And I guess ultimately, Steve, when I hear the comment, I'm like, I mean, I don't think you believe what you're saying. I don't think you believe what you're saying. There's so many ways to define tanking, and it seems like a number of teams are tanking.
Yeah, and it's funny because you bring up the Blackhawks too, and not only is it, do you want to say, like I said, tanking, but, you know, you bring up the players that they've already traded away, and there's already heavy rumors that Jonathan Toews and Patrick Kane are going to get moved by the NHL trade deadline, and basically the reason they haven't yet is because teams want them to eat up as much cap as they can before they trade and bring in their cap hits of $10.5 million, I believe it is, per season for the next little bit here. But at the end of the day, when you're going to move players like that, look at the trade deadlines across sporting world. the most active trade deadline is the NHL because teams get rid of their players for draft picks, whether it's seconds, thirds, whatever, firsts. But when you have young teams that are rebuilding and they want those extra picks, they're going to give away good young core players when they could sign them to help with this rebuild. No, what they do is they trade for first round picks and prospects to better their chances at the draft lottery that year. So it doesn't make any sense to be that naive and, like you said, to try and feed something that you really, I'm not buying it at all. It just, teams do it. And you look all across the league, the NBA has a draft lottery, but the NFL doesn't. You know, the NHL has a draft lottery.
Yeah, but why do you have a lottery? You have a lottery as a league because you understand that teams will tank.
Exactly. Right?
And so, the tanking does not need to be from day one of the season. In fact, if you have a lottery where 11 teams have a shot at the first overall pick, and a team by U.S. Thanksgiving is out of it, but they thought they would be in it, then that lottery may well incentivize that team now to take the foot off the gas pedal to dispatch a bunch of assets, become a weaker team with a view to increasing their odds to get that first overall pick. So I think any way you cut it, I just find that the existing lottery today doesn't discourage tanking. It actually encourages tanking. Now, Gary Bettman was also asked, Steve, he was also asked if the league is going to expand. And this audio, I'm going to have to play really loud here. He was asked if the league is going to expand. There are 32 teams. He said, and asked maybe if Quebec City might be a target. He said, look, we don't intend to expand. But Jeff Molson has said, if you do, I welcome a team in Quebec City. So here's what Gary Bettman said.
I know there's been constant speculation about that. We're not in an expansion mode. If we decide to decide to participate or have the possibility of expansion, we'll let people in Quebec City know, those who might want to own a team. This is a conversation Jeff and I have had over the years. I know there's rumor and speculation as to what the Canadian's position would be, and I tell you for certainty, Jeff has constantly over the years said to me, if, in fact, we as a league
want to expand, so, Steve, I remember years ago, I gave a talk, along with Paul Kelly, who was the former head of the NHL union for a very short period of time before he was fired at 3 o'clock in the morning. And Paul told me, he said, look, this was in advance of the NHL expanding from 30 to 32 teams. He said that this is about 6 or 7 years ago, the NHL's dream, Gary Bettman's dream, as he was told, was to have a league comprised of 32 teams like the NFL. And so the NHL has achieved that dream, expanding in Vegas and in Seattle. But I've been hearing some rumblings about possible expansion, and I kind of understand that a little bit, only because there have never been this many NHL caliber hockey players available in the world. It's very hard to find your first liners. But the waiver wire clearly demonstrates that there are a ton of third and fourth line players. There are a lot of really good hockey players out there that could fill the fourth and third lines, or third and fourth lines, and also the back end of your D pairings. So there's probably enough. There are enough players there. And when it comes to expansion and the players that you cannot protect, it certainly favors expansion teams. I've seen with Seattle and Vegas. And under the CBA, you have a lot of parity. So all those factors together collide to make expansion viable within the next 3, 4, or 5 years. I don't know if the league is going to expand, Steve. I wouldn't be surprised by it. But are they going to Quebec City? That would be shocking to me. That would be shocking because the NHL as a business would want to go to a growth market. I mean, their population is about 500,000. It's like going to Green Bay today. Right. Mm-hmm. It's not a growth market. It's not a large market. I can't imagine that other NHL owners would be excited about the prospects of expanding to Quebec City, because you want to expand to a city where there is significant growth potential when it comes to media rights deals, when it comes to generating revenue and profile in North America and beyond. And Quebec City is a rabid hockey town. But it's not one that fits the profile of a city where the NHL would expand. One that does fit the profile is, of course, Houston, the fourth largest metropolitan city in the U.S., ranked 7th in GDP in the U.S. It has an NHL-ready arena in the Toyota Center, an NHL-ready owner in Tillman Fertitta.
strong corporate support. 24 of the Fortune 500 companies are located in Houston. There's tremendous growth potential in Houston. Portland is another example. Maybe in a place like Milwaukee, small city, but probably has far better growth potential than Quebec City. There are other cities, Kansas City. Maybe another team in Toronto. I think they could support two teams, maybe Hamilton. But Quebec City, for me, Steve, when I look at all the economic metrics, to me, it's at the very bottom of that list.
Yeah, I agree. And especially when you bring up Houston, because you're forgetting they have Mattress Mack too, just a billionaire that loves to bet and gamble and have fun. But for me too, and expansion, I don't understand why the NHL wants to continue to expand. I think 32 was such a good, like 30 was solid, but and we saw quality of play and depth of players on teams go down. And to expand beyond that, it feels like a bit of a stretch. And I know for Quebec City as well, taxes are going to be a huge factor as well, right? Because that's something that I believe we've discussed before, the Montreal Canadiens at some point. It's hard to bring in free agents because of the tax purposes. Also, I believe when Quebec City was proposing this new arena that they were going to build and that I believe they have built, it kind of looked like a toilet anyway. So it's not very appealing for much players to want to go look at or play. So when I look at the situation, Eric,
it's rough.
Look it up.
It's a very nice looking stadium, isn't it? Made of wood or arena? It's a very nice arena. It's made of wood. Their philosophy was Field of Dreams philosophy. If you build it, they will come. You built it. Nobody came. It's kind of like me when I host a party.
No, and I'm more curious to see, and I know expansion is the topic here, but you know, is more a more viable option in this situation, relocation from another team? I'm not sure how that would work, but my thinking would be if Quebec City wants a team, it would be easier for a relocation than to do an expansion right now.
So I think a couple of things there, and that's a really good point. Number one is that the NHL now generates about $1 billion via its three main media deals, TNT, Disney, and Rogers. That has stabilized some teams to a certain extent. And so there aren't really a lot of candidates to relocate. Maybe Arizona, but we know Arizona is not going anywhere because of Gary Bettman's dogged determination to keep the team there. Because again, this is a really good case in point that despite the massive issues faced in Arizona, including owners that were evicted from the Glendale Arena, the NHL sees Arizona as a growth market. If they can get into temp, build an entertainment center there, including the team, they see it as a growth market and good for the league. They don't see Quebec City as a growth market. So I don't know what teams could relocate. The issue with relocation as well is there'd be a fee with that, but it's not the expansion fee of, say, $650 million divided by 32 teams. Every team gets a check for $20 million. Now, you may say to yourself, $20 million relative to what teams generate is not a lot of money. This is a $5 billion league, right, when it comes to revenue. Not profits, but revenue. But we've seen teams effectively sell their soul to place ads on jerseys, right? And that number is nominal, but they're still doing it. They want to monetize every inch they can of this league and this business, this joint venture that is the NHL. So $20 million would be very enticing. That times two, maybe around $50 million in all if they expanded by two teams. You don't get that if you relocate. I also don't know what candidates for relocation there are. So I think that's I'm not of the view, Steve, that the NHL is not going to expand. I think it's possible, and as I said before, because you know you mentioned the types of players that play hockey, there are enough players, I think, to fill up another two teams just because there's a lot of parity among third and fourth line players, and you can create that team. And because there's so much parity, if a team can get a star or two, then suddenly they're really competitive, or they develop a star or two, they're really competitive. I think there are enough good hockey players on the planet to fill up another two teams. Do you believe that?
I do. I do. I think there is. But then I think the other situation we then look at is, you know, quality and depth goes down for certain teams, right? And when we get to that, we then get into, say, the trade deadline and bottom feeders versus, you know, playoff teams. We talked about this last week, Eric, but then you're battling a salary cap on how, you know, I get depth players who are going to get more money, even though their quality isn't as good. You know, the quality is a bit down in terms of depth. But when you move it to the salary cap and you do need to make moves and the salary cap isn't moving up, that is where I believe there would be a problem. I don't know if that makes sense to you, but that's the way I look at it, is if things are going to happen like that, where you are going to expand and you're going to have, you know, bigger rosters, and you're going to lose because expansion drafts, you're, you know, picking some of the better or, you know, average players, depth players off of other teams to then build, you know, salary cap then down the road needs to move up. There needs to be a change financially, because like you said, they're making money on jersey ads, I'm sure hockey socks, and there's going to be more down the road. And I remember, I don't know, we've
tattoos on players' faces and a little Nike swoosh on a cheekbone.
It's already happening, right? I'm probably going to get one too, just so I can make some money. Because Eric, when we started working together, probably what, almost 11 years ago, you always taught me one lesson. The answer to everything in life is money.
The answer to all your questions is money, and also wear pants when you leave the house. I just got an email from Cole Caulfield. I've changed my name to Adidas. Oh, interesting. Interesting. That's what that league should do. Change all the players' names to brand names. They don't need names. It's ridiculous. You know, you raise an interesting question about the cap. I remember during the pandemic, I was saying on the show that the cap will be relatively flat for 3 or 4 years. And people are like, Eric, you're crazy. You're stupid. Put some pants on, right? But that's what we're seeing. Why? Because while the players had escrow, right? That is, the league will predict revenue for the upcoming season, and the players get paid upon that. They get 50% of predicted revenue. But if the league falls short, got to give some of that money back. So they have to give a lot of money back during the pandemic. They give money back, and they still share in revenue 50-50. So if they didn't give back enough money, they would still owe the league money. And so they still, all in all, about they owe the league about $650 million, which is why the cap is staying flat. Now, I'd anticipate in a year or two, you'll start seeing the cap get back to normal and go up every year by a few million dollars. But it's still a modest rise, right, in the salary cap. And it's pretty interesting. Pretty interesting. The cap is going up by $1 million next year, and this accounts for the NHL's media deals with Disney and TNT, which are substantial. So it really shows how much the pandemic harmed the NHL business. And it is a business that, as we know, has niche appeal and tribal support. And so it does struggle as compared to the three other sports from that standpoint. So I think we will see the cap go up, but it's slow. It's slow. All right. Why don't we take a break, Steve? We come back. Let's talk Josh Norris, Tanner Peterson, and issues over, hey, can they get surgery? Can they go their own route for surgery? Do they have to listen to the team? We'll talk about the legal issues there. Mike Clevenger is now under investigation by Major League Baseball for charges of domestic violence and, Steve, child abuse. And, of course, my Donald Trump loser of the week. He's Steve King Kong Bunda. I'm Eric McCormell, and this is Offside on the TSN Radio Network.
Wanted to let you know that a gentleman by the name of Eric McRamala, your legal guy, he says, might not be able to make it for 9:45 because he is currently stuck in one of our elevators.
He knows Lord and he's quite a manabella. Oh, what a bum, and he's quite a manabella. He knows all manabella, walla walla.
Hey, McRamala.
Welcome back to the show that is Offside. I'm your host, Eric McCormell, along with my co-host, Steve King Kong Bunda. Steve, will talk Mike Clevenger in a moment. He's being accused of domestic violence and child abuse, and is currently under investigation by Major League Baseball as per its joint domestic violence policy. But let's talk some more hockey. Josh Norris out for the season, decides to get shoulder surgery. Cole Caulfield as well has done that as well. Tanner Peterson has had issues with a hand surgery he underwent as a result of an injury that hasn't worked out for him. And I'd be getting the question a lot, Steve, you know, can these players decide if they're going to get surgery? The team says, no, don't get it. We just want you to rehab it. He's like, no, I want to get surgery. Can they go their own route and get surgery not recommended by the club? Right. Cause we saw this with Jack Eichel. The Sabres and Eichel were at odds over the type of surgery he needed to get on his spinal cord. And spinal cord's pretty important. And what I would say to that is this, is that The CBA does provide that, you know, the team can provide recommendations as to surgery that a player should get or treatment a player should get. Absolutely. But ultimately, the player decides. Because without the player's consent at law, a doctor is not going to operate on that player. So Jack Eichel wanted a more innovative surgery on his spinal cord, and he ended up getting that when he was traded to the Golden Knights. And that is his prerogative, as it was with Josh Norris, his prerogative to get the surgery now. And so long as the surgery the player selects is an accepted type of surgery that reflects and is aligned with medical practice and guidelines, then the player is entitled to get that surgery, Steve. And so you often hear about these disputes between players and teams. But ultimately, the test is going to be, well, look, the surgery that the player wants, is it reasonable? Is it an accepted type of surgery? And if so, that player is entitled to get that surgery. It's their body. And without them consenting to a more traditional surgery or treatment plan that a team may suggest, the player can't be forced or compelled to do what the team wants them to do.
Yeah. And this is tough because we go through, you know, we went through this with Jack Eichel, like you brought up before in the past. And, you know, you look at the situation and a player wants to look out for themselves. And I want to ask you, too, the difference here, because Josh Norris just signed an 8-year deal with the Ottawa Senators this, a year or two ago, you know, worth about $63 million. And this is very, like, very new into his new deal where he is having the surgery and situation. When I look at Jack Eichel's situation when he was with Buffalo, he was nearing towards, he's still part of his deal as well, but, you know, he's got a couple of years left, not as many as an 8-year deal that Josh Norris is going through. But, you know, are teams more hesitant early on after just shelling out this kind of money, mm-hmm. Eric? And if a player does not, what is the legal action that, say, Josh Norris, if they blocked him and said, no, we don't want you doing this, you listen to our doctors or else? Is there any kind of legal action between a player and a team? Because, like you said, there's a contract there abiding you to what, you know, you're supposed to do.
You know, you raise such a great point because teams invest so much in these athletes. And under this current CBA, with your, you know, with your top tier players, you're looking typically at a 7 or 8 year deal. In excess of $60 million. So the invested cost on that player is substantial. And so you understand why these teams take treatment options very seriously. And this is why we had Eichel up against the Sabres and why the two parties were at odds. Ultimately, if Josh Norris or Tanner Pienaarson they're able to argue that the medical procedure that they are proposing is in keeping with established medical standards and practices, the team can object all they want, but they can't stop the player from pursuing those treatment options. Now, you don't want the two sides to get together and agree. I think what happened to Sabres and Eichel is unusual. However, if Josh Norris says, well, look, I want to fix my shoulder. I want to go to Macedonia. There's a guy in a cave, and he uses leeches. And while he places leeches on your shoulder, he shocks you while punching you in the face. Well, the leech electrocution punching in the face treatment is not going to be aligned or in keeping with accepted medical standards. And that could irreparably inflict harm on Josh Norris if he's being electrocuted, right? To the point where he won't be able to discharge his employment obligations under his current deal. So in that circumstance, if you are going a route or you are agreeing to surgery that is not considered by anybody in the medical field or a group of people in the medical field to be reasonable under the circumstances and an accepted type of treatment, and you get surgery and you can't play again, then that team can move to void your contract. Say, look, we suggested, Josh, that you get the shoulder surgery. It's accepted. It's been done many, many, many bigly times. But you went into a cave and got punched in the face and electrocuted with leeches on your shoulder. And now, as a result of the electrocution, you've lost all feeling in your arms. So when you walk, for example, you don't swing your arms. It's very confusing. But also, you can't hold your stick. So we are going to void or terminate your deal, which means we won't owe you a penny on that. Now, I want to be clear about something. I mean, the example I gave is a pretty extreme and silly example, obviously. But there could be arguments that, you know, that a treatment option selected by a player is not consistent with accepted medical practice and standards, such that a team could argue that they can terminate that deal if the player cannot play after that. They could argue that. It's a very tough argument to make because the law really on a totality tends to favor employees in these types of circumstances. And that's what Josh Norris is an employee. But I don't know how you feel, Steve. Jack Eichel got a lot of bad press when he was engaged in this feud with the Sabres. I think part of it was a result of his personality. You know, for some people, they don't find him to be entirely pleasant. I don't care about that. Second overall pick, incredibly talented, really good hockey player. And I loved what he was doing. I loved what he was doing because he was going for the more innovative practice that in 5 or 10 years will be the accepted practice. And it turns out he's a point of game now, right? So yeah. I loved what he did. I don't know what was your reaction to Jack Eichel and these types of issues generally, but I was a fan of Eichel and how dogged he was and how he stuck by his guns or his scalpels.
Yeah, and I think the big thing too was that, you know, he was standing up for himself and doing what he was doing. And I believe that there was probably a lot more going on in Buffalo because there was always, you know, a lot of the players that left the Buffalo Sabres organization didn't seem to speak very highly of what was going on there. I'm not talking medically, but in general, the way the organization has been run. When I looked at Jack Eichel standing up for himself, betting on himself, because at the same time, you know, he is the one that has having the surgery done to himself, right? He is the one that has to risk, you know, not being able to play the sport he loves, the sport that he gets paid to play. You could not walk again. You know, there's so much that can happen when you go into a surgery. So to take that odds that is against the team and, you know, stick up for yourself and do it regardless of a team trying to control you. I understand contracts. You have to listen, you know, you have to abide to them, right? You have to deal with that. But at the same time, if you don't agree with it and you have medical, medical advice that, you know, this will work, try this out, and it will be something, like you said, in the next couple of years, I was all for Jack Eichel doing that. I guess my last question on this for you, Eric, would be, you know, how does the team monitor this situation? Because at the end of the day, they're contracted to have this player, and this player has to then abide by the contract. But at the same time, if they're going to give permission to do that, do they monitor the situation the whole time throughout the surgery, throughout the rehab? Like, is this something that once you give up that ability to, you know, go to a different doctor, do they just say, okay, well, come back when you're ready? Or is this a situation where they have to be a part of the process from day one?
Yeah, I'm thinking of Tom Brady when he had his ACL surgery. He went his own way. And we've seen a lot of athletes do that. Maybe the team isn't wild about it, but athletes have surgeons they trust. Athletes have medical or healthcare professionals that they trust, but it doesn't exclude the team from remaining involved or trying to remain involved. And an instance where Josh Norris, let's say, goes for his surgery on a shoulder, or a player just goes for surgery like Eichel, the Knights, who were okay with that surgery, but let's say they weren't wild about it, they would still try and stay involved because they look at a player as an asset. An asset in which they have invested so much money and they have a lot riding on that asset. In the NHL, if you have 3 or 4 star players, you have a shot at a cup every year because most teams don't have them. So you have a star player like Eichel, you want to make sure that you do all you can to ensure and position him for success. So they would stay involved. But in the case of the Sabres versus Eichel, I mean, that was just an all-out brawl and fight. I mean, there was no way to repair that relationship. And I kind of, you know, some doctors like the traditional approach and other ones like the innovative approach. And that can turn on experience as well as personality and risk tolerance. But ultimately, it's the player that carries the most risk, as you said so beautifully with Jack Eichel. I mean, you're having surgery on your spine. You're the one carrying that risk, because if it doesn't go well and the team wasn't on board, you're out of a job. Not only that, like they could terminate your deal, but you have no subsequent deal because now you can't walk. So there's a huge risk associated with it. And the player understands and consents to that risk. But I do like the idea, Steve, of individual athletes asserting their own personal rights in the medical field. All right, why don't we switch gears, Steve? Let's talk Mike Clevenger signed a one-year, $12 million deal with the White Sox. Clevenger's had Tommy John surgery at one point. I think it could be said he was a legitimate Cy Young candidate. I think surgery has taken its toll on his body. He pitched for the Padres last year, ebbs and flows, up and down, not a great, great season, which is why Padres said goodbye. Latest story, though, is Olivia Feinstead, who has a child with Clevenger, has accused him of physical and emotional abuse towards his three kids and the two mothers, including herself. She accused Clevenger, quote, of several acts of domestic violence and child abuse, including throwing chew spit on a screaming infant child and also strangling the mom. So as a result, Clevenger is under investigation by Major League Baseball as per his joint domestic violence, sexual assault, and child abuse policy. The issue now is what happens. Miss Feinstead took to Instagram, it was an Instagram story, and she posted photos of herself, of her body, with bruises on them. And she said, you know, she's tried to give him chance after chance after chance, suggesting that this was not an isolated incident or that the incidents that she recounted in her story were not one-offs, that this reflects a pattern of misconduct. And so the next step here is MLB is conducting its investigation. There's no timeline on that. If they haven't finished the investigation by the time the season starts, they'll put him on paid leave. It's 7 days at a time, but you continue to renew that suspension on paid leave. And then once that's done, they are going to decide whether Clevenger is going to be suspended. And I guess based upon past cases, including Trevor Bauer and Sam Dyson, Julio Urias, a number of other players, it would seem that the circumstances are such that there's a chance here, Steve, that we could see Clevenger suspended for a substantial amount of time.
Yeah, and you know, it seems like you said, we just talked about this with Trevor Bauer and multiple players, but you know, you go back to Adrian Peterson, right? And you know how he would discipline his son. Tyreek Hill, I believe there was a complaint about him punching his son in the stomach from his spouse at the time. And you go through these athletes now and what they're dealing with, and all of these cases starting to kind of come up a lot more often. The way I look at this situation here with Clevenger is, pitchers and catchers are going to be reporting in about what, a month or so from now, in the next couple weeks. Mm-hmm. Where it's a situation where you'd like to be able to see the paid leave and not come around until this investigation has been completed. Her posting those pictures and putting this out there, it's big because it's evidence, as you know, in the legal world, is evidence is everything. And if she's going to have pictures and she's going to have all this, it shines a bad light on Mike Clevenger here. And, you know, we talked about Trevor Bauer and how he was reinstated and how quickly teams were already looking to acquire his rights once that happened. And rather than, you know, do the better thing where they ignore said player for what he's been through the last little bit and all the legal issues, I don't like seeing this happen. And I know we have to wait for the investigation to play out to have a full official ruling, but for that, I kind of wish, I don't know if it's legally possible, Eric, and I know you'll probably have a different answer on this, but I'd like to see the MLB just step up and say, you know what, you're going to be suspended indefinitely until this investigation has been completed.
Okay. So that's a good point. So the joint domestic violence policy is a collectively bargained agreement between Major League Baseball and the union. And so when you have a collectively bargained agreement and you have an instance of domestic violence covered by that agreement, it triggers the agreement and you have to do precisely what is in the agreement. Now, the agreement provides that the commissioner, Bob Manfred, has broad discretionary powers when it comes to ultimate discipline. Now, when it comes to suspending a player with pay pending the outcome of the investigation, that can effectively be indefinite. It was with Trevor Bauer.
Mm-hmm. Now, Trevor Bauer's suspension was reduced from 324 games to 294 games on appeal, and he also got credit for, quote, time served, 50 games. But the policy does provide broad discretionary powers for Major League Baseball, and it affords them all the time they want to complete the investigation, which is what they want to do here. I look at this case, and I think of the case of Roberto Osuna when he was pitching for the Jays, and there was a single incident outside of a building of domestic violence, and he was suspended for 75 games. You're looking at suspensions for domestic violence at around 75 to 85 games. That's typically what you might see. The issue here for Mike Clevenger is if the allegations are true, it also includes allegations of child abuse. Child abuse is going to result in further discipline. That I guarantee you. So it would not surprise me if Mike Clevenger was suspended in excess of 100 games and maybe for an entire season. And under the policy, it can be recommended that he also go into counseling and get therapy, which is what Ms. Feinstead has requested in her IG posting. So I think 75 games is the bottom number for Clevenger if the allegations are true. When I read them, I'm like, oh, Clevenger's got an uphill battle here. But who knows? They're just allegations. We wait. Every player should be afforded due process, and they are under this policy. And Clevenger will get a chance to talk to Major League Baseball. And baseball will assess his credibility because this is he says, she said, right? There's nobody else there. If it's just the two of them and kids, it's really his word against her word. Mm-hmm. So the league will have to assess credibility. If she's right, because of the child abuse claim, Steve, I think he's looking at minimum 100 games, if not an entire season. All right, why don't we take a break, come back with my Donald Trump loser of the week. He's Steve King Kong Bunda. I'm Eric McRamell. This is Offside on the TSN Radio Network.
And we had the most beautiful piece of chocolate cake that you've ever seen.
They're losers. They're just losers.
Suffers from a thing called loser's remorse. She lost.
Well, Rosie's a loser. She's always been a loser. We have losers. We have losers.
And Cher is somewhat of a loser. She's lonely. She's unhappy.
Look, Glenn's a loser, okay? Just so you understand. This guy's a serious loser.
Welcome back to Offside. I'm Eric McRamell, your host. You're along with my co-host, Steve King Kong Bunda. Steve, you heard the music. It's time for my Donald Trump loser of the week. Are you ready for it?
Oh, I'm always ready for some bigly losers. Because nobody is a bigger winner.
I heard that Donald Trump had a golf tournament at Mar-a-Lago, and he lied about his score to win the tournament. He was the president. He's already a winner.
Eric, in the intro, do we not hear that nobody is better than him?
Yeah,
like he's not lying. He's just naturally better than everybody.
He also loves chocolate cake. All right, so my Donald Trump loser of the week, it's the Vancouver Canucks for how they handled Bruce Boudreau's firing. By the way, Bruce Boudreau is a good coach. He's well over 500 in his career as a coach and coached a lot of games and good coach. But that aside, employers will conduct themselves and carry themselves in a way I think that reflects their culture, their values, and ultimately, Steve, who they are. The Golden State Warriors have a great culture, and we see that. This team wins year after year after year, positioned for success, and you feel that team culture, the organizational culture, is so strong that it promotes that level of success. The Canucks seem to fall on the other end of the spectrum. It is incomprehensible to me, Steve, incomprehensible. The way that they treated Bruce Boudreau. Basically, you're fired, but could you continue to coach for three more games if you don't mind? We'd really appreciate it till Rick Tocchet gets a chance to get on the plane and come down for a presser. That reflected so poorly on the Vancouver Canucks, and it reflected these inherent flaws in the Canucks organization, right? Here's the thing is that teams that are successful engage in organizational excellence. I've talked about that on this show for years. Organizational excellence is key. You have it with the Golden State Warriors. You had it with the Patriots for a long period of time. You've had it with the St. Louis Cardinals. A lot of teams engage in organizational excellence, and as a result, they have success on the field. That's how it works. So success starts at the very top and trickles down. So the Canucks are a dysfunctional
organization. This is why they're not going to succeed now and likely will not succeed in the long term, because the Canucks are a dysfunctional organization. The Canucks have shown us who they are, right? Didn't Maya Angelou say, hey, when someone shows you who they are, believe it? The Canucks have showed us who they are, and they have inflicted irreparable harm on this team. It will be hard, Steve, I believe, for this, for the Canucks to recruit players, because other players are texting Canuck guys going, is this really happening? Is this really, really true? Players will not want to come to Vancouver. It's tough enough to get NHL players, good NHL players, to come to Canadian teams because of the issue of taxes and all the attention, yada, yada, yada. But now you have a team that is so dysfunctional that players will not want to come to this team. So, Steve, the Vancouver Canucks, for the way they treated Bruce Boudreau, they are my Donald Trump loser of the week.
Nobody's stronger than me.
Nobody has better toys than I do.
Nobody builds walls better than me.
There's nobody that's done so much for equality as I have.
There is nobody that respects women more than I do.
The sale of the uranium, that nobody knows what it means. I know what it means.
Nobody knows more about trade than me.
Nobody knows the system better than me, which is why I alone can fix it.
Yeah, Eric, you know, the one good thing is at least they brought in a nice new coach in Rick Tocchet, who has a clean history and no issues in the background.
I'm betting on it.
Yeah, I'm betting on it too, because if you're a situation where I get that there's only 32 NHL head coaching jobs available, but if you're Rick Tocchet, what is your appeal to go to Vancouver currently? I don't understand. If you see how they just treated the prior coach, now you're pretty much a lame duck. It just doesn't make much sense. But the Vancouver Canucks, I feel terrible for Bruce Boudreau, because, like you said, he seems to be a very good players coach. He's been a great coach throughout the NHL. All coaches get fired, basically. So, you know, it happens. But at the end of the day, he deserved a lot better.
And look, you could fire him if you want. It's the way that you fire him. Mm-hmm. That's the issue. The way you fire someone tells us everything that we need to know about you as a business. And right now, the Canucks are a dysfunctional business. Steve, thanks once again for joining me here as a ghost on Offside. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I'm going to come over now and start shoveling your driveway.
It's okay. My butlers have it, but they could probably use your help. Thanks a lot, Steve. He's Steve King Kong Bunda. I'm Eric McRamel, and this has been Offside on the TSN Radio Network.
Rosie's a loser. She's always been a loser.